My ex-husband, my children's father, sexually abused my daughter's best friend. They were 14 at the time in an ice fish house, and all of my kids were there, ages 10, 14, and 15, along with nieces that were under 5. Child Protection and the police never filed an order for protection on my behalf. I had to hire a lawyer and pay $8,000 to protect my kids through family court, and even then, they made my son call him. He fought the protective order, and the judge dropped it, saying there is no domestic violence. Before they dropped it, he violated it. Because he had money, he drug it out for 20 months, and they ended up giving him a stay of adjudication while he was out on bail with no conditions for first-degree criminal sexual conduct. When you violate your bail by committing another crime, you should be held. He was not, and no one would listen. They played the angry woman card on me. When he violated it, the cops wouldn't go look for him and kept saying they couldn't find him. My sister and I located him ourselves and called the police and waited for them to come. They didn't want to come. They actually were really not taking it seriously. He's in prison right now. When he gets released, there will be no protective order to protect my kids and me. I could say so much, but it's so lengthy. I've also worked as a domestic abuse advocate since 2015, and the amount of orders for protection that don't get granted is insane. And the amount of police officers that don't enforce them is even more insane. And the court system that gives them a slap on a wrist and doesn't hold them accountable is even more insane. It is so bad. Hi, I'm Zahn Valliens, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. I am a feminist writer and activist. You can learn more about the podcast, about me, and about my work at liberatingmotherhood.org. Today, we are talking about the family court system and specifically how to improve your odds of winning. And my guest is an amazing one. It's Caitlin Jorgensen. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi, Zahn. Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad to have you here because you're like a celebrity in the world of activism. And I have no doubt that you have saved and changed so many lives. So let me tell you guys about Caitlin, if you're one of like the three people listening who don't know who she is. Caitlin Jorgensen is a family court strategist who helps women tell their stories in a way that the courts find compelling. Too often, trauma inhibits our ability to tell our stories well. This is where Caitlin comes in. She knows how to talk so judges will listen and can help women pare down their stories to the most important elements. You can follow her on Instagram at caitlin.jorgensen. I'll also link to all of her socials and contact information in the show notes. If you are going through the family court system right now, she is an invaluable resource. Caitlin is not a lawyer. She does not give legal advice. She's a supplement to your legal team. She's part editor, part friend, part counselor, but she can really help you because ultimately what you're doing in family court is you're telling a story and she knows how to tell stories.
Thank you for that introduction. I appreciate that. That was nice to hear. Believe it or not, I often get stumped when people say, well, what do you do? Because in my head, I'm just a fellow survivor. I am what I refer to as a proactive, protective mom. I certainly consider myself a strategist working in the community and working with fellow survivors and through my advocacy work online. My platform has really been built, and it has been created through information that I have learned through my lived experience, both as a child within the family court system and now as an adult mother within the family court system. And I really have just tried to ensure that every protective mom who's navigating this system has access to information, support, data, and that they have access to, content that makes them aware of what's to come. Because when I started doing this as an adult, I very naively thought that the system would have changed between when I was a child, 30 years ago, and an adult. And I was shocked to learn that the system has not changed. And there was very little information out there as to what to anticipate while navigating family court proceedings. So I'm very happy to be here, very happy to engage with you and talk with your audience about my experiences, both personally and professionally.
So I think one of the reasons you're so helpful, Caitlin, is that the family court system is an entirely different world Unless you mm-hmm. are a lawyer or a paralegal, mm-hmm. you probably have no real understanding of how the legal system works. It's a bizarre right. system. And whatever you think about how it works, it's probably wrong. And yes. so you're kind of like an anthropologist of the legal system who just like, you know, guides people through its bizarre customs and practices.
It is bizarre. It absolutely. Is.
So there's this widespread belief that I think is starting to change but still persists mm-hmm. that family courts are biased against men. Since mm-hmm. most mothers do end up with more than half custody, the idea is, well, if she's getting more than half custody, it must be biased, like never mind the mm-hmm. fact that she was the only one ever raising the child. Mm-hmm. For listeners who are new to this issue, can you talk to me a little bit about why that's not actually true that it's biased and what kind of world women encounter when they enter the family court mm-hmm. system?
Sure. I mean, let me tell you what bias is. Bias is awarding a father who, historically speaking, has been absent, neglectful, violent, temperamental, controlling, 50-50 custody or full custody after he has voluntarily relinquished time with his children when he has not participated in their care in any capacity and shown no interest in them. Until the mother leaves him. That's bias. That is assuming that every child should just have immediate access to their father simply because they share genetics and DNA with him. So this narrative that moms are just constantly awarded custody is, first of all, the data doesn't support that. There's data out there that shows that this is just an inaccurate assertion. In addition, what we're just seeing on an international scale is that not only are fathers being awarded generous access time just because they're fathers, in many cases, on an increased basis, fathers are being awarded full custody after making false allegations against the mother. So, you know, when we talk about bias, to me, that is just the biggest component to this because it assumes that if a father has children, he has automatic rights to those children, whereas the mother genuinely does not.
Yeah, it's the idea of children as property and of property Correct. As belonging to the father. It's Correct. Not that different from how things were 150 years ago under laws of coverture.
No. Absolutely. And just a little side note for your listeners, I am 100% pro-father. I believe both a mother and a father is needed in a child's life, but safety should take precedent above giving immediate access to an unsafe parent simply because they share genetics with a child.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's important is, you know, I think about my own marriage, which is an equitable right. marriage with someone who is a good father. And mm-hmm. in my marriage, if we were to get divorced, to try to deprive my children of access to my husband would right. be an act of abuse. And I think that we have this idea that if we just pretend that there is gender mm-hmm. equality, that there right. will be. So we just pretend that right. men should have half access to children that they've never participated in raising.
Right.
And that's not equality. That's actually child abuse because children need to be with a loving caregiver, not any specific gender of or number of caregivers. So this is not anti-father. This is about when parents split up, children's entire way of being shouldn't be disrupted. And we should generally try to preserve what's healthy about the status quo.
Absolutely. Children should have access to what they've grown accustomed to. Their standard of care and their standard of living should be prioritized and maintained above all else, in my opinion.
Yeah. And it's galling to me that this is not the standard in family courts, that the standard is amorphous and mostly focused on what the father wants.
Absolutely.
And one area where we see this a lot is you do a lot more direct work with victim survivors who have experienced abuse, but I've found that I'm doing more and more of it because there just aren't enough people doing this work. Right. And so in the past month, I've worked with, you know, dozens of women who are seeking protective mm-hmm. orders, and mm-hmm. they all have horrifying stories. You know, the man who waved a gun at an infant, the mm-hmm. man who has repeatedly threatened to slit his wife's throat, You know, the man who is stockpiling guns and has cameras on his wife at all times, you know, the man who has put multiple air tags on his partner's car and holds her accountable for every single place she goes. All of these men have been hitting, raping, otherwise assaulting their wives. And all of these men share something else in common, which is that when their wives sought protective orders, the courts did not give them protective orders, leaving these women with not even the flimsy piece of paper that a protective order is. And these women have something in common, too, which is that they're all traumatized by these men and that that trauma makes it harder for them to tell their stories. And I think that's where you come in. So talk to me about why women have such difficulty telling their stories of abuse and how that gets weaponized against them in family court.
Sure. I think a big component to this is that most women are not aware of what's expected of them. A lot of us grow up, you know, in our culture, we have TV shows like Law and Order, for example. And, you know, the imagery that we see culturally is that when and if a crime is committed against you, a cop is going to go get the bad guy and you'll be safe. And so when we as women enter these systems, so to speak, there's almost a feeling of relief, like, okay, I'm sounding the alarm, now help is going to come. Per my lived experience and per the experience that I have professionally, that is just simply not the case. When you sound the alarm, so to speak, you basically open up Pandora's box and there's very little preparation for what is to come. Per my lived experience, for example, when I was 3 months postpartum, that's when I initiated this process and I filed for custody. And there was no assistance whatsoever. Everyone just kept telling me, I can't give you legal advice. I had no idea what to do back then. And so, you know, when we talk about presentation and we talk about why women don't present well due to trauma, this is a huge component to that because there is no middle person in a lot of these areas that say, okay, this is how you get from point A to point B. This is what's expected of you. And that's really what my platform has set out to change because I want women to understand that, yes, it's courageous to ask for help. And yes, I encourage you to seek remedies, you know, and to secure you and your children's safety. But you have to do so with an objective and with the awareness that there are now expectations on you. It is very difficult for an at-risk woman to identify expectations and to even meet them because she's at risk, right? So my hope has always been to create these thresholds so that women present better. Because it is really hard to present well, again, when you don't know what's expected of you.
So what is expected of women in the family court system? What do courts want to see?
Generally speaking, per my lived experience, not legal advice, what is expected.
So I want to interject something here. The reason we are so gung-ho about saying that this is not legal advice is that no matter what women do to try to push back on an unjust system, men push back harder and try to silence those efforts. So for example, you know, we had midwives delivering babies until doctors took over that and tried to criminalize midwifery. And now what we have is we have mostly male lawyers trying to criminalize helping other women, advocating for them, even something as simple as editing a woman's statement, which is obviously not legal advice, trying to make that into you're practicing law without a license and you can't do it. It's fundamentally a constraint on free speech and on relationships.
I 100% agree with you. And it's very frustrating, particularly as a survivor, communicating with fellow survivors, constantly having to add those disclaimers and constantly, you know, feeling the paranoia of if I assist, could that result in some backlash? You know, to me, that is actually a perfect reflection of what is expected of women within the family court system. Take it, don't make a fuss, and don't try to essentially move forward. Back to your original question, what is expected, generally speaking, of women within the family court system is to accommodate the father above all else. I have been advised by my attorney that, you know, the father could end up in jail and I would still be ordered to facilitate visitation. And so there's this threshold of, okay, there's really nothing I can say or do here that prevents him from exerting himself over me and the child, right? And women, you know, are expected to be okay with that. Mothers are expected to be okay with that. And that's difficult for me to even articulate because it feels in itself so constraining and like such an injustice. But what I have found is that when women push back, when they organize amongst themselves with their communities, when they try to get support and legal advice, et cetera, if they step out of line more than they already have by seeking safety, generally speaking, there's a severe consequence for that. And that is a consequence that most women and moms are not willing to pay because their ultimate priority is to safeguard the child.
Yeah. And I think that what often happens when mothers enter this system is because their focus is on the child, they focus on the things that are most relevant to the child, like how the father has treated the child, whether he has provided a safe home, whether he's been a decent parent. And courts really don't care about this. They really just only care about violence. That's the only thing that might tip things in the mother's favor. So could you talk a little about what courts don't care about and what they may care about when you are seeking a protective order or seeking more than 50-50 custody?
So generally speaking, what I see is that they do care, but that, again, this is where language comes into play. For example, I get in touch with moms who are holistic, who homeschool, who breastfeed and co-sleep. And this is a more traditional style of mothering, right? Old school style of mothering. And they go in there saying, well, I'm a co-sleeper. You can't take my child from me. They've never slept apart from me. Not realizing that they just opened the floodgates for the father to suggest that the mother's enmeshed with the child and inappropriate with the child, right? So what I have seen work in family dynamics like that is for the mother to simply highlight that she's the primary caretaker to the child, that the father has never participated in childbearing duties. He has never put the child to sleep. The child has never spent prolonged periods of time alone with the mother. Okay. Her and I are basically saying the same thing, but one, again, opens the floodgates to she's enmeshed and she's crazy. And the other is more structured. Okay. I'm not prepared to say that the courts, quote unquote, don't care, generally speaking. What I am prepared to say is that it depends on how you layer it. And it depends on how you approach your storytelling. Generally speaking, if, again, you open a window for the father, the perpetrating father, to make emotion-based allegations against you, you will face an issue. If you work towards shutting that down, though, and not creating that opening, what I'm seeing in my work is that successful results can be obtained. Again, this is why my platform focuses on things like knowing your language, anticipating bias, knowing how to tell your story, because I would love for women to be able to say, I'm a homeschooler, I birthed at home, I'm a co-sleeper, we are doing, you know, breastfeeding extended on an extended basis, et cetera. I would love for women to be able to share their true journeys as mothers. But what I'm just seeing again and again and again is that deviates from the norm. And generally speaking, our systems just don't like anything that's not quote unquote normal.
Yeah, I think that's really important, is like knowing what the system is that you are in and knowing that you know, you can't turn this into a dispute over parenting style because the court doesn't right. want to intrude in that way. But you can make it about what's in the child's best interest, what preserves the status quo, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And the bar for women to be perceived as crazy, as unreasonable, as you noted, enmeshed, is on the floor. Like one wrong move and all of a sudden completely normal parenting decisions are made out to be evil and objectively awful parenting decisions are made out to be fine. But I also think that this can play out, like, not just in court, but in a woman's own head. Because these destructive relationships break down a person's sense of self by design.
Absolutely.
Abuse victims often feel that they deserve it and that if they just behave better, things would get better. As a result, most of them don't even see their abuse as abuse, especially if it's not physical, or they even think that they are the abuser. And I see this over and over with women where they're not able to prominently highlight the most important pieces of abuse because they're so in their head and so guilty. How much of your work involves, like, convincing your clients to see the reality of their relationships for what it actually is?
Well, by the time I meet with my clients, they know that it's bad because they felt propelled to meet with me. But I do often meet women who say, it's not that bad. I'm sure you've dealt with worse, right? And every time I hear that sentence, I interrupt them right away. And I said, you booked a call with me. You are engaging with my platform, which means it is that bad. Okay, I just want to affirm that. And to anyone listening today who is relating to any of this, I want you to know it is that bad, okay? Because what I have noticed in my work is that 90% of my clients are not being physically abused. And so they are under the impression that they're not able to gain reprieve, that it's not that bad, that nobody's going to take them seriously. And what I'm seeing through my work on a very frequent basis is that that is simply not true. If you know how to articulate what is going on, okay? When I hear from a client or a woman who says it's not that bad, 9 times out of 10, she is tiptoeing around her home. She has no access to finances independently of her partner or husband. She is enduring everything from sleep deprivation, food deprivation. Her children are being called names, their toys are being broken, she's being disparaged, she's being really targeted and isolated, okay? And by the time that she tries to articulate that to me, what it oftentimes sounds like is that, well, he doesn't hit me, but he gets really mad at me. And I again have to interject oftentimes and say, listen, starting your storytelling out like that will open the door for someone to disregard you and say there's nothing to see here. He may not have hit you yet, but he has established that he is capable of and willing to. And you know that based off the fact that you're tiptoeing around your house in fear of him, right? And I have said that exact sentence a few times now. And anytime I say it, I just hear silence on the end of the phone because the client, the mother, realizes, I've told this story a few times. I've discounted myself from the beginning. And now I'm realizing that, wait a minute, he hasn't made physical contact with me, but I know he desires to. And I know that his end goal is to make me feel like he can do that to me. And it's like a revelation, right? So like, when we say, again, knowing your language, this is part of why. Because she now understands, I can't disregard this. And I have to make sure that nobody disregards me when I share what the father of my child has been putting us through.
Yeah, I think that's really important because I think a missing piece of all of this is that abuse is both an individual and a systemic problem. And so he often doesn't have to literally hit you to bring down the full weight of patriarchy into your relationship because we all know that men are potentially dangerous. So they can weaponize that danger against you without actually physically harming you even if they are willing to eventually do it. So talk to me a little bit more about the kinds of language and narrative shifts you encourage people to make. Like, what are some mistakes you see? And what are some rules that people can follow to tell their stories a bit more effectively?
Sure. What I generally speaking see in terms of storytelling is that a lot of moms, protective moms, are very lengthy in their storytelling. What they ultimately do when they sound the alarm is that they have this laundry list of things that the perpetrating father has been doing. And they basically start off with, and then he did this, and then he did that, and blah, 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 blah. And they lose people because, again, what that does is give an opportunity for whoever is listening to discount the mother by saying, okay, well, this has been going on for 2, 5, 6, 10 years. I even had a client who had been married for 30 years, okay? And they listen to her and they say, all of this has been going on for such a long time and you did nothing about it, right? You're an accomplice here. You have participated in this. You know, all of a sudden, it's so bad. I don't really want to listen to this. They, 9 times out of 10, people don't come out and tell you this to your face. They just treat you this way. So what I have seen be more effective is to focus on the father's patterns of behavior versus his individual transgressions and the individual incidents that led up to the mother finally seeking reprieve. Generally speaking, again, these fathers navigate the home very aggressively. They isolate the family unit. They make veiled threats a lot of times. What I'm seeing often is that the father presents very well in public, but in a much different way within the home. Highlighting that, highlighting the mother's dedication to the family unit, to the marriage, tapping into what is, generally speaking, expected of a mother and a woman, I see being very successful. A lot of women are primed to believe that if I just absorb this, and if I just do what he wants me to, and if I just keep trying, then things will be better and the family unit can remain intact, which is my ultimate goal most times, because we're facing that societal pressure, that systemic pressure, the pressure from the perpetrating father to really just keep going, right? So what I generally speaking see, you know, cause an issue is, again, that lengthy storytelling, the giving someone the opportunity to say, well, this has happened so many times, and suddenly now you want to say something. What I see shifting that mindset and that bias is highlighting the need for urgent intervention, highlighting recent escalations, and then tying it together with the father's patterns of behavior and why he is an ongoing safety concern to both her and to the children.
Yeah, one thing I see over and over again is you emphasizing a pattern of behavior and a pattern that is escalating. Talk to me about why that's so important to talk about.
Because the father's not changing.
Yeah.
Right? What he's doing now will continue in the post-separation period. He will continue to be domineering. He will continue to exert himself over the mother and the children. He will continue to make demands of the mother and the children. And the reason it is so vitally important to highlight the patterns of behavior is because that is a factual assessment of the father, okay? It's not emotion-based. Most perpetrating fathers use emotion-based arguments against the mother, which is part of why we don't focus on the nurturing and the mothering as much as we do, I'm a primary caretaker, because that is a factual assessment of the mother, right? Fathers, perpetrating fathers, generally speaking, are emotion-based because they understand that motherhood is emotional, and they understand that people's biases against the mother are emotional. So that is why it is so important that the mom stays factual in how she communicates about the father and his patterns of behavior, because the patterns are not changing. So whatever she reveals now is to be expected of him through the post-separation period. I am of the belief that it is better for a mother to reveal details about the father's behaviors and patterns and have it fall on deaf ears than to not reveal anything at all. Because in the post-separation period, he will revert back to baseline and engage in that behavior. And hopefully then the mother will be able to say, I have been sounding the alarm on this entire time. Will somebody listen to me now?
I love that. I noticed that you talk a lot about, you know, men weaponizing certain aspects of motherhood and kind of knowing exactly how to do that. And I think that's really important because we have this idea that abuse is accidental, that abuse is a loss of control, that abuse is an anger management problem, when the reality is that there is a misogynistic playbook and these men know what they're doing.
Yes. A lot of these men not only know what they're doing, they actively resent the mother of their child for being the mother that they never had.
Oh, interesting.
And so when we talk about the emotion behind it, in my experience, the emotion stems from what the father has been denied by his own mother. And that is not to blame his mother or to continue any misogynistic trope, right? It's just to acknowledge that the father has felt entitled to certain things from his mother. Generally speaking, it's been denied to him. So when the children arrive, he is reminded of that and he can't handle it. And that's part of why my belief that most perpetrating fathers don't fully deteriorate and escalate until their children arrive. Like if you talk to protective moms, every single mother I speak with says when the babies arrived, he never returned to baseline. I didn't recognize my husband. I didn't know who I married. I didn't know who I had a child with. He grew so vicious and so violent and so angry and resentful of me. And I don't know why. In my opinion, this is why. In addition, abusers know the biases that their victims are going to be met with. They are very calculated. And so when they assert these tropes, it is to gain community, to gain support, even from within the mother's immediate family unit. I see this all the time. Right? Because she's trying to break free, not just from him, not just from systemic issues, but from her own family unit to preserve the children. And this is just how these men isolate, how they belittle and abuse, and how they create this environment that's what I refer to as crazy making, right? Which is, again, not to beat a dead horse, part of why my platform focuses so much on structure. And giving the mother structure, giving her a foundation to build off of, knowing what to anticipate, knowing how to articulate. Because if she stays within that framework, her both my lived experience and professional experience, she can come up for air. If she fails and starts feeding into his narrative about her, that's when the floodgates really open in my experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. And also the bit about the family of origin, it is shocking to me how many of these men recruit the woman's family to their side and just rob her of any of her community. And it shows how there's kind of a family to husband pipeline of abuse, where your family of origin primes you for the abuse and then your husband kind of finalizes the process.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah. I mean, women, just a little side note, women don't just end up in these relationships out of nowhere. Certainly there's a systemic component to this. There is, you know, the perpetrating father has potentially targeted her and all of that. I'm willing to acknowledge and entertain that. I will say, though, my experience dictates that there's a family unit behind him, prior to him, that has really normalized these behaviors. And that's part of why the protective mother didn't notice prior to conception.
Yeah, that's so important because it's not that he became abusive, it's that he just revealed more of his abuse. So we have an advice question from a reader. I still love my abusive soon-to-be ex. Intellectually, I know he will never change. I left him to protect my kids from his emotional abuse, which was starting to escalate toward physical violence with a lot of threats. But I still want to be with him. It took so much work to leave. I am constantly second-guessing myself and wondering if I am overstating the abuse or if perhaps I am the abusive one for abandoning him. I know that I need to be strong in family court, and again, my core self knows that he's abusive. But how can I be strong when I'm going face-to-face with someone I love who makes me doubt myself?
I believe you can be strong by focusing on what your parental obligation is, making it that simple.
I love that.
When a perpetrating father fails to honor his obligation to both his partner and his children, that leaves the children one healthy parent. And your feelings don't supersede that. Your feelings don't supersede your parental obligation. As we can see, the system is not going to advocate for children and mothers. They're not going to elevate safety above all, which means that you need to. There's plenty of time to be sad. I get sad about mine. I cry about him to this day. Okay. I'm all for acknowledging the sadness, the mourning, the grief. There is 110% room for that when you are safe and when you have stability, routine for your children, and hopefully some resemblance of safety. But while you're going through this, it needs to be one foot in front of the other, very black and white. What is my parental obligation to my children?
Am I
meeting it?
Yeah, I think that's wonderful advice. And it may seem kind of like tough love advice, but I think that, you know, ultimately what we need to be saying is you don't have the right to subject your child to an abuser, even if you love him. And
you know
what he is.
Can I tell you something about tough love?
Absolutely.
I don't think it's even tough love. It's just respect.
Yeah.
I respect protective moms enough to tell them how things are. And I think we are so desperately need that in this field, so to speak. People treat domestic violence survivors like they're idiots.
Yes.
And like they're somehow incompetent.
Yes.
And like they don't know how to make executive decisions for themselves and their children. That is not accurate. And we would see more women successful in family court and beyond if they were treated as competent parents, women, and individuals. No survivor needs tough love. They need respect. And they need someone to say, like, listen, you can do this. This is what's going to be required of you. Now go execute. Right?
Yeah. I love that of presenting it as a challenge that she can surmount rather as something that she just needs to be terrified of and worry about. I think that's part of why you're so effective is that you can just be direct and tell people how it is and tell them what they're capable of, because like that's women crave that, because women spend their whole lives being told they're not capable.
Right. And then you go through this process being told you're incapable. You feel stupid. You feel like you were taken advantage of, that you're a fool. Now you have children. You don't have two pennies to rub together, potentially. A lot of us experience housing insecurity. We don't have access to transportation or community. And then you enter these environments and no one tells you what's going on or what's expected of you. And people baby you. I absolutely refuse. I absolutely refuse. I genuinely believe that if we give women and protective moms the tools to move forward, they will. And like I said, there's room for emotion, sadness, all the facets of this. But you have an obligation. And we need to urge women and moms to meet the obligation that they have to themselves and their children.
I love that. And I love you for that. Thank you so much, Caitlin, for coming on here. Again, Caitlin is offering something that like you really don't get anywhere else. So readers, if you're going through a divorce or seeking a protective order, I urge you to really seek Caitlin out. She can spend the kind of time with you that like your lawyer can't spend with you. She can help you tell your story in a way that is not just compelling in court, but maybe compelling with your friends and with your family and your employers and all the people who you really need on your team. So I feel really lucky that we have a Caitlin in the world. I'm going to put Caitlin's information in the show notes so you guys can reach out to her. And I will talk to you in 2 weeks.